You are now listening to Horticulture's In Between the Podcast with Jason Horsley talking to Tom Mellett about the Lavender Code and other stuff. Busy night streaming last night, and you were in it, and Peter Lavender was in it. It was a very restless night. And,
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a result of me being particularly, you know, intellect or mentally invested in this conversation or anything. I think it's more a deeper. I got the sense there was something deeper going on there, but anyway.
Yeah, it is. It's. I get it. You know, it's. Deeper than I think all of us are really. I mean, I did. I've known Peter online for 10 years now, but it wasn't until that picture, that photo you had of, well, he had actually sent it to me and my friend Bob. We know each other from the Arthur Young group, and Peter had come there to because of he wrote about the nine in his first. Book in the Sinister Forces trilogy, and Arthur Young, who was a good friend of mine, was part of that seance with Andre Puharich and the Dr. Vinod channeling the entities called the Nine. So that's the opening of Peter's book. That was one reason he came to the Arthur Young Yahoo group in 2006, where I'm the moderator. And the other reason was the connection with Ruth Hyde Payne, and because Arthur Young was married to Ruth Forbes Payne Young, and her son was Michael Payne, you know, who married Ruth Hyde Payne, and Ruth Hyde Payne befriended Marina Oswald, and got Lee Harvey Oswald his job at the Book Depository in Texas, thus making her one of the central figures in the conspiracy theories.
Right.
So that's what brought Peter Lavender to the list. And then my rapport with him is due to the fact that I grew up in New York City, just a few neighborhoods over from where he was in the Bronx, and so we have that kind of New York City shtick going back and forth. But it didn't bother me that much about the thing about Ruth Hyde Payne, even though I know that she is not part of the conspiracy in the JFK conspiracy. I'll go into that for another time. But it wasn't until all his stuff came out about the secret, you know, the Tom DeLonge and the secret machines. And then Peter himself sent that photo of you know, the photo that you put up, mm-hmm. about taken with John Podesta in July. It was last July. So what's converging together is the whole, I mean, not just the wrote about the whole Pizzagate aspect, but then there's the UFO aspect with the Podesta emails.
Why did he send you the image?
I think we had been talking about it, because I had actually, he just sent it. Here's something, just your information. Anyway, and then when I saw that, and then I realized, I have been sitting on this. I haven't really, you know, confronted Peter directly about the whole thing with Ruth Hyde Payne. I just kind of let it sit. It's been sitting like for the last 10 years. But there's something also about the I said, well, he's doing this book on the secret machine, on the UFO connections, which ties to Podesta through Tom DeLonge about the UFOs. But then there's the other angle tying the Podesta about the whole, Pizzagate.
Yeah, which Lavender wrote publicly about
And then,
recently.
and then he only when he also mentioned when he was on that when his book, the I'm calling it the Lavender Code.
Easy mistake, PLH and PL.
I guess we're talking about the Lavender Code. But when his Lovecraft Code book came out, then he appeared on Facebook for the first time, and he's a newbie to this, and I've been on Facebook for a long time, and he I can see that he has he was he felt he was dragged kicking and screaming by the publisher to get a to make a Facebook account just to get publicity for the for the book.
I didn't know
So for myself, because of my interest in Arthur Young, who invented the Bell helicopter and then who founded the Institute for the Study of Consciousness in Berkeley in the early 70s. And he was like the sort of Gertrude Stein figure for this. There's a book about it called The Hippies Who Saved Physics by a professor at MIT. I forget his name, but these are the guys, the physicists like Fred Alan Wolfe, Jack Sarfatti, others like Elizabeth Rauscher, who was living on the farm in North Carolina when Puharich died. So she's connected in that sense. So what's fascinating to me is the whole sort of mystery of this. Here's Peter with his whole career, but it starts really with this Simon Necronomicon. And the ambiguity about that, well, did he forge it, or is it, is he the author, or did he really find it? I mean, was Alan Cabal lying when he said that, oh yeah, Peter and a bunch of guys there at the Magical Child bookstore just, did it all together as a hoax? And in one sense, that doesn't matter because of that article, I sent you about, I think, Joseph Flatley, Joseph Flatley, about the idea that Lovecraft himself would be meticulous with factual details or facts, which then are linked together in such a way that, wow, it looks it, they could be really these could be really true, but they may not be. And the whole idea of it's like a hoax that has all this plausibility. Well, so if that's the Necronomicon, and here's Peter now at the other end, 40 years later, he's coming out with Secret Machines with the whole idea, the same ambiguity with the UFO disclosure thing. Is this for real, or is this just another hoax or disinformation or something? What the way we can appropriate it is by belief. Either I believe it or I disbelieve it. And I think Peter, as a good writer, he plays upon that. The whole ambiguity of the Necronomicon at this end in the late 70s, and then now the Secret Machines coming out, and pressed in the middle of this is his novel, The Lovecraft Code, which came out by December 1st, and all this stuff about the DeLonge and Podesta, comes out. Trump gets elected, and then now we're waiting. There's a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity about it, but that keeps the game going. That keeps the ball rolling.
Right, well, that's the UFO in a nutshell as well, like the very fact that it's a like the brain can't leave a mystery alone. If it can't solve it and it can't dismiss it, it can't stop returning to it. So that's the UFO in a nutshell, and occultism and hidden conspiracies, and they're all of them are these things we can never quite find the proof for, and yet we can't dismiss what evidence there is either.
And one of the things I see is like in this issue with like Ruth Hyde Payne, because I myself have talked to her about, 15 years ago. And I know a woman named Joan, who was the sort of executor of Arthur Young's estate. She just kind of laughed at the innuendos that say Peter and like saying, well, Ruth Hyde Payne made this trip to Pennsylvania to visit Arthur Young and his wife at the same time she had, took in Marina Oswald in Dallas. And I would love to hear that conversation. And Peter is putting these facts together, but he's linking them all by sinister forces. And I'm saying, well, what about the Dexter forces? And I had a phrase that I used that I said that she got Ruth Hyde Payne got Lee Harvey Oswald that job at the Texas School Book Depository out of the goodness of her Quaker heart. But you talk to any JFK conspiracy theorist, and of course she is the, she is like, she has to be involved in the conspiracy because Oswald had to be at that building in order for the assassination to take place. Right. So she has to be implicated. But what if she wasn't? From my view, she wasn't. I'm content with the sort of Bugliosi side of that Oswald was the lone gunman.
What's the? I'll come back to that in a second. What's the reference to Dexter forces?
Well, I made that as Dexter being right and Sinister being left.
I see. Gotcha.
Because Peter writes Sinister Forces. And what I see is that, okay, you gather all these facts together about people. Then there's like guilt by association. It's kind of like McCarthy. I call it McCarthy Ishtik. You have innuendos that arise from only connecting the dots, the correct factual dots with sinister forces, a sinister interpretation.
So you actually think Leo Harvey Oswald shot Kennedy?
It seems the most plausible to me because the way in the conspiracy that Ruth Hyde Payne has to be so implicated in the conspiracy to because she did get him that job at the depository building. Therefore, there had to be a guarantee that Lee Harvey Oswald would be at that building in order to take the blame. He had to be there as much as the shooters in the grass, in the front or the grassy knoll or whatever.
Right. So, don't necessarily want to get sidetracked in this. It's just a bit cognitive dissonance to hear somebody say that they thought Lee Harvey Oswald shot Kennedy at this point, because it just seems so proven that story doesn't add up.
Yeah, I used to be a JFK assassination buff until I met, it was just kind of a casual conversation with Arthur. I think when he said something like, well, oh, yeah, because he's very deeply into astrology. Both of us were, he's a very good astrologer. And then he was going over dates in his life and he said, oh, yeah, well, that's the date that Ruth and I testified in the Warren Commission. I said, huh? And then he told me the whole story about Ruth and Ruth, his wife, Ruth's son, Michael, who married Ruth Hyde Payne. So I'm I guess up in the air about the whole JFK assassination thing, and then I'm up in the air about the all the stuff about the Pizzagate and about UFOs and this whole thing. And so it's sort of in that kind of floating on this kind of ocean or uncertainty. Well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe
right.
Yes.
You haven't collapsed it yet into.
Yeah, there's no. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the collapse of the Schrodinger cat.
Yeah.
So
when you're talking about Lavender and how he was joining these dots and inferring and even reaching a conclusion about Ruth Payne, I guess you read the exchange he and I had about Crowley.
A little bit of it. I haven't, yeah.
Okay, so, well, it'd be better if you'd read it all, but I'm curious if you, like, it sounds as though what you're saying Lavender did with pain is exactly what Lavender was accusing me of doing with Crowley, which is essentially that I juxtaposed all these things we know and said this is pointing towards Crowley's complicity with ritualized abuse of children.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's kind of one of those sauce for the gander and goose issues. Yeah, it's exactly because he didn't. Now, what Lavenda does is leave. He doesn't really overtly accuse, but he just leaves it hanging there. He says, "Well, here's the facts I gathered about Ruth Hyde Payne and Arthur Young," and he'll say, "Well," he says, "Boy, I would have loved to have been." A fly on the wall at that conversation between Arthur Young and Ruth Hyde Payne in a month before the assassination in Pennsylvania. And I asked Joan about that. She laughed. She said Ruth Hyde Payne would never have told Arthur and Ruth, the elder Ruth, about her personal life, meaning that she was, had Marina Oswald living with her in Dallas. And so it's just so you're right. So, but we're in a, I think we're at a point now where it's almost, I think it seems impossible to prove either way. Is there, well, I don't know. Yeah, there's this, all this pointing toward the conspiracy, all this not. And so we go back and forth, and we seem to be all like in this, I don't know, realm of uncertainty about it, or well, it could be, and there's always somebody said, well, yeah, now, hey, believe this, it's over here, so we put our belief over there, and those guys are wrong, so we spent them out, but then, oh, so what I see is like maybe it's the ultimate ambiguity of our existence.
Thank you.
Didn't you mention in an email something about the vendor conflating two levels of reality? Do I remember that rightly?
Yeah, I think it's the was it the, I forget if I was talking about metaphorical or
Well, I think it's about Schrödinger's cat. Yeah, so with the from a quantum mechanistic model and/or an occult kind of viewpoint, we can say this, that everything is in uncertainty. But as far as the cat's concerned, and as far as we're concerned, if the cat's actually there in a box, I know that's a sort of weird if in this context, but still there are these two levels where, like, we know that children are being sexually abused. We know they've testified, it's happened to some of us. We know people. This is just reality. We know it's high level, it's organized, that there are things that we know, and yet there's also, as deep as you go into it, it starts to overlap with these other narratives that do seem to be either they're genuinely occult and they are genuinely happening in some non-physical realm, or they're narratives that have been created to create that impression, right?
Yeah, in other words, yeah, okay, yeah, now I remember. Yeah, the whole, because in the shorter year, the cat is either alive or dead, right, in our physical materialistic experience. However, at the level of the quantum formalism, the cat is in this quantum juxtaposition where it is both alive and dead at the same time, right? And that's because we're coming to it with our, kind of our Newtonian worldview, and this we have to try to or to explain it in those terms. So there is, and then, but I think the whether it's the like the magician, I think I mentioned David Blaine or Peter Levenda, who was influenced very strongly by Norman Mailer, who the writer who one of the like Tom Wolfe and Capote, who brought us the whole thing of blending of fiction and nonfiction. But I think what Peter writes so well about is he leaves that ambiguity. He's always said, well, that what if well, maybe the cat is dead, but there's also this other level where it could be alive.
Well, when it serves him, he leaves it, but when he wants to clamp down on someone else questioning stuff, then he doesn't like ambiguity at all, it seems.
Well, when it's a matter of his ego, right, or his self-image or whatever in being the expert, the authority.
Yeah, although you could say with Pizzagate, there was no apparent reason he would have a dog in that race, except that he was photographed with Pollister, and seems to be pally with him. But besides that, it doesn't seem, it's not like he's written about, you know what I mean? Like, and even with Crowley, well, actually, if we look at Lavender's record, particularly if he is Simon, then he has advocated Crowley persistently, I would say. But he denies it, and he says he doesn't have any particular thing, you know, thing about Crowley. But if that were true, if we take him at his word, then why be so persistent and thorough with trying to shut down my own arguments? I mean, some people would say he was just being polite and he was engaging me, but that definitely wasn't the impression I got. The impression I got was similar to his Pizzagate address, which is grow the fuck up and be a real researcher like me.
Yeah, so this will be really interesting to see what when the Secret Machines book does come out. And because to me, what this may kind of explode the whole UFO disclosure thing, the way Pizzagate took off. And I think I may just be waiting for like that the Levenda's Secret Machines book to come out before this really gets going. Because by now it's under wraps. He's doing a few interviews here and there where he'll talk about some of the ideas that are or will come out. But so I think it's like the year of the dis you know the disclosure.
Like there was a disclosure plan for 2017, and whether it's actually going to be possible now, it might have depended on Hillary getting in. It's even possible that they miscalculated that. I don't know. It seems hard to believe, but whatever the case, everything, so many of the things seem to be lined up, the ducks, and specifically Lavender and DeLonge is the obvious thing, but then the WikiLeaks emails and the comments Podesta was making, and even Hillary about the UFOs. So,
Yes, maybe. Yeah, I think I used the term one time, something like this is going to be like the disharmonic convergence, the old harmonic one was, I think, back in 87.
The first one, yeah, there are a few, I think.
But actually, this is not. It's not so much a convergence, I think, as a divergence. It's like things are, sort of exploding out, because you've got the whole Pizzagate with the child molestation thing. I don't know what to make of that. And then I think, well, what about all this UFO abduction stories about the sexual experimentation? Is that another aspect of connected with the pedo, another layer connected with the pedophilia stuff going on? Where does this, because to me, that's where the UFO, Podesta would meet like the Pizzagate Podesta is something to, what about these UFO abduction stories?
Yeah,
And
exactly.
the focus on the sexual experimentation and sexual abuse.
Yeah, well, Whitley Strieber is the exhibit A there, because he testifies to both. He testifies to being experimented on by the U.S. government slash Nazis as a child, and then of course the visitor experience.
And then all this is embedded within the ambiguity of it, whether or not he's Simon, or if is there. I hadn't realized. Did you know Simon's last name?
No.
Well, I saw it on the Coast to Coast, AM on the. It's Cabana, Simon Cabana.
Oh, so that's the rhythm's exactly the same, the
Yeah,
syllables
Simon
are
Cabana. So like Copacabana, and Peter does live in Florida, and but I hadn't realized that until I was on the Coast to Coast AM website, with George Noory, and or I think because Joe, who was it, Mr. Flatley had written in the article that he had supposedly, right, Simon was on with, I believe it was the not with George Noory, but the one of the other hosts, saying, who was recorded, and Flatley said, well, he slowed down the recording, and it sounded just like Peter Lavenda.
Yeah, have you not heard that audio then?
I was searching for it. I couldn't find it. It said the video or the audio was missing. I haven't been able to find it.
Yeah, and as Levent, I mean, my wife thought that he had admitted to being Simon. I mean, that's how kind of sure she was, but maybe he's just hinted so many times that it seemed as though he'd actually said it, but he never actually did, I presume.
Or he's caught with this reality that he did it, and here we are in the electronic age, the media age, when all this stuff comes out, and so he's got to make the best of it.
Well, I mean, isn't it about, I mean, besides the ego of wanting to have his cake and eat it, not really say it, but let people know, isn't it also the whole point of the hoax and the stunt is you don't admit to it. It doesn't even matter if people know, you still say no, of course. Otherwise, it's over, right?
Yeah, and then yeah, like the masquerade ball, it's not there is no unmasking at the end. But again, that comment by Flatley about the way that this is how Lovecraft did it, to spin a hoax but make it sound so plausible that people actually believe it, or they're terrified that it might be true, and then they believe it's true. So I think the key is in there, because it's his homage to Lovecraft. And then there he comes out with the Lovecraft Code.
Yeah, well, because it may be more than a homage, because he may be keep upholding a tradition of sorts, or a method, an agenda, even.
Yeah, and part of that, I wonder if have you seen the video of Peter? There was somebody filming a meeting of the OTO recently, and there's Peter marching in with Jim Wasserman. Who was part of that crew at the magical child bookstore?
Wasserman.
Jim Wasserman.
Okay. No. No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, all right. It should be. It's been many months since I saw it, but it's something that was filmed just a couple of years ago, and it was a. It might have been a British program about the OTO or something, but he was filmed in, you know. We're going to show this meeting of the OTO. And so there was Peter just, again, appearing, you know, not appearing like Zelig. Nature, just as he appears in that photograph of Podesta, you know, there's Tom DeLonge, and then here's Podesta. Who's this guy with the beard, you know, and then, you know. Only a few know that it was. That's Peter Lavenda, you know. and his role in this is under wraps until, you know, March 6th, right, the date of the publication of the secret machines. So the other aspect is also when he first told Veeam Bob about the secret machines, I mistook the earlier book, which was the co-written with A.J. Hartley, who is a fiction writer.
Yeah.
And that was, oh, this is the fictional aspect. And then now, oh, Lavenda's is coming out. That's the non-fictional aspect.
Yeah, yeah. So
right in the middle is the Lavenda Code, right? The Lovecraft Code by Lavenda.
Right. But Lavenda also, in that quote where he's defending fiction as a means to promote truth or communicate truth. Is he talking about the Lovecraft Code there, or is he talking about secret machines? Do you know?
No, secret machines. He's talking about secret machines.
Right. So that's odd, because his book isn't fiction anyway. He's writing the non-fiction one. So.
Yeah, but he's writing it in a fictional way. I mean, this gets back to the whole influence from Norman Mailer and writing using techniques of fiction to write nonfiction, and then it all blends together.
Oh, okay. So then, first of all, we've got the DeLonge Hartley one, which is actually fiction, but it's based on truth.
To tell the truths in a novel form, and then now we're coming up is Lavenda, the nonfiction. You know, he's the historian, researcher, etc., who's to give the nonfiction side. But in a fictional, but with techniques
with
of fiction.
Narrative, yeah.
Narrative.
Yeah. So that's totally blurring the line.
Totally blurring from both ends. And in the middle is his publication of the Lovecraft Code as a novel.
Yeah.
He said it's not his first novel, but it's his first ever published novel, which comes out right in the middle between these two sort of bookends of secret machines fiction, secret machines nonfiction.
Yeah, and also so that while he's...
So the fiction, nonfiction ambiguity.
Yeah, while he's talking about fiction as a vehicle for truth, it can seem as though he's talking about the Lovecraft Code also, even if he doesn't overtly refer to that.
Yeah.
That's going to be implied. And it's something Strieber said too, you know. He said at one point that there are certain things I can't write about in my nonfiction, so read my novels because you'll find it in there.
Yeah, and that's the what's very interesting is the I sent an email recently of, you know, the whole idea of the MacGuffin.
Right.
As Hitchcock, I think, first really brought it out about the MacGuffin, there was a website that had the 10 most famous movie MacGuffins, you know, like the Maltese Falcon, you know, that's the, and I looked at number 7 was the Necronomicon, But it was, I forget, it was a movie with, was it, oh, it was a different movie, but it used the term Necronomicon as a great MacGuffin. And I had already written, I think Peter on his, I think on the email or in a web, on a Facebook maybe about that. Well, that the Lovecraft code, the Necronomicon is the MacGuffin, right? Mm-hmm. And the MacGuffin, according to Hitchcock, is something that may or may not be true. It doesn't have to be true. It could be totally empty.
It creates its own context, and then the context makes it real, right?
And so here, the Necronomicon is the MacGuffin in the Lovecraft Code novel. And yet the whole approach, you know, what's the MacGuffin in the UFO? What's the MacGuffin in the Hartley novel? But I don't know about that, but I do know that, you know, I can say, well, the MacGuffin is definitely the Necronomicon. And then that's, well, is he Simon, you know, or, you know, if there's that ambiguity. So it's always.
It seems as though the MacGuffin could almost double for a red herring in this context. Yeah.
Right.
Because you put a MacGuffin in the context of something real, like you could say Pizzagate is a bit like this. There are a lot of MacGuffins in Pizzagate, which are red herrings, and people end up creating a narrative around these MacGuffins, and they end up with a false narrative, and that disguises what's really going on.
Yeah, whereas in the movie or the novel, the MacGuffin is the big thing.
There's no story without it, right?
And they may throw red herrings along the way to divert you. But yeah, leading you down this path and then, you know, swinging back this way, but always, you know, in search of the MacGuffin.
Yeah. And eventually finding it, and the story has a happy ending, and yeah, the MacGuffin is the story, really.
Some of them may be real objects, I guess, like the Maltese Falcon with Bogart, but others may be just, like you say, whatever you project onto it.
Well, one of the definitions Hitchcock gave for it was that it's something that the audience don't care about, but the characters care about. And so the audience grow to care about it simply because they care about the characters.
Yeah.
But essentially it's this microfilm inside a statue, and it's like, so what, you know? Even if it's a diamond, it's kind of so what. It can't be money, you know? Money isn't a MacGuffin, because audiences really do care about that. They want the characters to be rich. But a piece of microfilm that the government's trying, they don't care. They just care, you know, because the characters do.
Yeah, well, what is the MacGuffin for Tom DeLonge?
That's a good question. You look at his site. It's a heavy merchandising site, right?
Yeah, right. So he's, you know, cashing in on the disclosure. But it's interesting. I mean, when I think back to the whole hoopla about 2012 and the end of the Mayan calendar, you know, it's just like, you know, God, it's over 4 years ago. And, you know, the world didn't end. But now we... well, at that time, there was a lot of, you know, the whole idea of disclosure seemed to be so so cut and dry, like clear. Well, either, you know, but now it's precisely because of Peter Lavenda and DeLonge together. It's and with the whole Lovecraftian idea that now the disclosure is just this big MacGuffin, or maybe it's a red herring, you know. I think I feel more ambiguity now about UFOs than I ever did before, you know.
So how did you meet Arthur Young then?
Well, at first, I was actually at the I was at the University of Texas. It was 1977, and I just happened to be at the home of a woman who was leading a Rudolf Steiner study group, and she had just come back from a South Indian temple dancer. And had come back from a workshop, and there were these two books on her side table I was thumbing through before the meeting, and it was Arthur Young's Reflexive Universe and Geometry of Meaning. And then that was 77. Turned out to be the week of my first Saturn return when I was 29 years and a few months old. But I didn't meet Arthur until 1981, when I moved to California, out to Sacramento. I was actually going to Rudolf Steiner College in Sacramento, and then I decided to call up. I said, "Oh, Arthur's in Berkeley," and so I got to know him in 1981, and you know, through him I met a lot of fascinating you know, people like. I was there for one of the first public presentations of The Face on Mars by Richard C. Hoagland in 1983.
Do you know anything about John Glideman and the Mars Anomalies Research Society? Have you heard of them?
Yeah. What's the name?
John Glideman is the guy, the man, and then it's called the Mars Anomalies Research Society. It's something Strieber talks about.
Oh, I've heard about that, but I think that's... That may be more recent.
Same period. It just struck me enough to interrupt you because Strieber claims that he joined that society in 84, and Glideman showed him a picture of the face on Mars, and Strieber believes that was the trigger that began his abduction experiences as an adult.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, the other thing with Strieber, I didn't read much of his, but like his claim that he was at the University of Texas during the Whitman shooting in 1966 is simply not true. I mean, I was there 10 years later, and you know, but so
how do you know it's not true though?
I don't know. He was in San Antonio, wasn't he?
Well, he was also in London. It's a bizarre thing. He graduated, by his own account or by the evidence or whatever, he graduated from London Film School, London School of Economics, and University of Texas, all three in 1968. So I don't know how somebody does that.
Well, it's by... Well, he's like maybe those saints who bilocate or trilocate, right? Yeah. It was an interesting period in my life. That's where I met you know, Hal Puthoff and even in 94 at a conference met where Jacques Vallée, who was written the introduction to
Secret Machines. Yeah, I saw that,
you know, book. And I got to know, knowing from Arthur Young, because Hal Puthoff was on his board of directors of the Institute for the Study of Consciousness. And I met, you know, Chris Bird, author, you know, who wrote The Secret Life of Plants, and then was a good friend of Arthur. So,
right.
But all of this is occurring, you know, before, you know, like I think Arthur died in 1995, It's kind of the year the internet really took off, I suppose. So it's fascinating to look back, you know, to think of pre-internet life before the internet. What was, you know, we have memories of it, but they seem.
Yeah, right. It's like we superimpose the present on the past. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And when did you meet Peter then?
Well, just online. I've never met him in person. Oh, okay. I never talked on the phone. It was just that he was he had joined the Arthur Young Yahoo group that I'm still moderator of. It's pretty defunct right now, but But it was that was back in 2006, and then I got to the, I just Nick wrote to him, and then with my friend Bob, friend who we all are from that group, so.
Yeah, I know, because you said that, and I got confused because it just seemed so strange how you were around in the same areas and with the same interests, and even knowing the same people, or at least people that Lavender went on to write about,
Yeah,
right?
Arthur Young and then Ruth Hyde Payne, who
Yeah,
was that? And
and because you were there, like you were in New York in the late 70s when the Necronomicon came out.
no, I was in no, I was at the University of Texas. I lived in Austin from 76 to 80, and then the early 80s, I was in Sacramento, California, and then 86 to 98, I moved back to Austin.
And
So,
in 75.
well, 75. Oh, I had just gotten out of the army, and I had lived in Houston.
Okay. So you went in
So
New York for.
I had left New York City in 1972,
Okay.
and didn't really, I was born and raised there, but I sort of left the city, and so yeah. So I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know Bender or any of the people involved except by, what I read it on the internet, so it
A
must be
long
true.
time later, right? When did you first hear about Necronomicon, Simon's Necronomicon?
Oh, well, that yeah, I guess just in looking at Peter's path, I mean, it was always there. I said, oh, this is fascinating, but I wasn't that interested in it. It didn't really, affect me one way or the other, and it really hasn't. It wasn't until like this past summer that it really just, whoa, this is, wow, there's something here. So I've been sort of, I don't know, sitting on it or, for the last 10 years, not giving it much thought, or, I wasn't that interested in it. I was never really interested in the occult. I was more, I got more in, I grew up a good Catholic boy, and then I kind of shifted right into my occult interest became Rudolf Steiner and anthroposophy because that's kind of the Christianized form of theosophy. So I could sort of reconcile my Catholic upbringing, I suppose,
Right.
with Steiner's anthroposophy. And it was interesting is the Waldorf school connection is like I remember when I moved to Austin in 1986 with my wife and daughter, and I told Arthur Young about it, and he said, "Oh well, Hal Puthoff just moved there," and then so I met well I actually met Hal Puthoff when he was giving a lecture on his ESP research at Rudolf Steiner College in 1984, but his wife Adrienne Kennedy, they had founded the Palo Alto Waldorf School. So I don't know how much you're familiar with the Waldorf school movement. And then in 86 I would meet Hal every morning. We would at the time, just for about 2 years, my daughter went to the Waldorf school there, and Hal would drive his kids, so we'd see each other every morning. And so there was, there's some like overlap with but not much with the Steiner world, and so I mean I brought that up just to say, well, I was never that interested in the darker, theosophical or the Crowley stuff and the Lovecraft stuff. I and it's only only in the last half year that it's really, oh, there's something here, and then here we are.
Right.
So yeah, so it's sort of, I guess you could notice things sort of, maybe they build up or they gestate and then suddenly they sprout. So anyway.
Yeah, well, just the other night, well, I spoke to Nick Bryant recently off the record. Do you know Nick Bryant, the Franklin Scandal?
Oh, I just heard a little. No, I think until you had emailed me about him, I hadn't really known about him. And but I heard a little bit of the podcast or in the interview he was doing. So I'm not. What were you were trying to make the point about that he was connected with Peter Levent?
Well, no, he is connected. I mean, they're friends. You see, first, I mean, I know of Nick Bryant because he did a lot of good work around the Franken scandal, which was exposing organized high-level child abuse. So he's one of the most credentialed researchers in that area in terms of really doing the field work and bringing something to light. So I knew of him. Then when I got into this exchange with Lavender, and he was pulling rank on me, essentially, and one of the ways he did it was say, "I'm a friend of Nick Bryan, so it's not as though I'm naive about organized abuse. I know the reality of it, but you're way off beam here, etc., etc." So he referenced Nick Bryan as a friend. And then, when I listened to Nick Bryant's interview, weirdly enough, Bryant brought up the vendor, how he'd just had lunch with him. And the reason he brought it up was because he was saying Pizzagate, he wasn't sure about it. There were definitely some people making some leaps. And for example, my friend Peter Lavender, is quite upset now because of this picture of him with John Podesta is causing people to associate him with Pizzagate. So it was kind of like he name dropped the vendor, but used it as an example of researchers, jumping the gun kind of thing. Anyway, despite that, I emailed him to see if he'd want to talk with me, and he responded, and I had a conversation off the record with him about possibly talking with him. And he brought up Lavender, and he just said, I was quite surprised, but he said he was aware that Lavender and I had come to blows, so to speak, clashed pens. I don't know how. I didn't ask whether Lavender had actually brought it up or whether he'd just read my blog, probably the latter. But he didn't seem to be disturbed by that, and so we had a conversation, and not about Lavender. Although Bryant did say that he disagrees with Lavender on various things. And just as a side point, one of the things Lavender seems to be keeps arguing against now with me and now more publicly is this the association of Satanism with ritual, with abuse, with child abuse. Like, he's denying pretty much that there's a ritualistic or a satanic element. And that was one thing Bryant did say that he disagrees with Lavender about. And I think it is very relevant to Lavender's position here, that he wants to disassociate occultism from child abuse.
Right. And so that's, because it's funny. I mean, that's what I see about him coming onto Facebook, and like that he was reluctantly dragged by his publisher. But now he's, I want to say because of it, but he is stuck to this tar baby of the, and he can't avoid it, of the whole Pizzagate thing with the UFOs. And I think it's only going to intensify.
I think so, too, especially if he's trying to put it out, trying to damage control, because that makes it worse.
Yeah, it is. The more, right, the more he tries to pull himself away, the more, the more he gets stuck to it.
Yeah. So anyway, just to finish where I was going with that, I am, because I talked to Bryant and I thought I might be talking to him again, I went to my and also I mentioned Streber in relation to organized abuse and the alien abductions, and I can't remember, it was to do with MK Ultra and psychic hacking, and anyway, and so Bryant said, yeah, I know Streber well, and I thought, so I looked online, and sure enough, they'd done a Dreamland together, so Streber had interviewed Bryant, so I figured I figured that must be what it was, or it doesn't mean they don't have a relationship beyond that. But anyway, so I went to my archives of Streber audios, and I put that one on my MP3 player, and then I was looking for one that I saw online at Streber's site. It was between Lavender and Nick Bryant, and I thought, I want to listen to that one, but I I couldn't find it, but I saw an audio file that might have been, because it said special edition or something, and that for some reason I thought, I'll just try that one, maybe that's the one. I have a lot of Streber audios, and So I listened to the conversation between Strieber and Bryant, and then the one that came up, it turned out it wasn't Lavender and Bryant. Coincidentally, it was Strieber and Lavender,
Oh.
and this was right after my wife had said, I talked about you and Arthur Young, and she'd said, "Who's Arthur Young?" And I'm not sure, and so we need to research that. So I didn't remember. I have researched the nine, but I didn't remember. And on this audio that I listened to, it was Strieber and Lavender talking about Arthur Young, and not only that, a lot of it was about what Strieber calls the coincidence stream, and how these weird things just happen, and you just find the things you're looking for, without apparently having any control over that. So it was a very weird sort of, convergence of different elements. On one hand, it was a genuine coincidence. I can testify to that. But on the other hand, well, the context of the conversation itself was very interesting, and part of the reason I bring this up, besides as an anecdote in terms of what you're referring to, like things just seem to be just constellating now, was that the way that Lavender talks about coincidence, I find questionable. Like he seems to use it as a way to, like it's this thing of conflating the quantum reality with our lived reality again. So, and when you were talking about sinister forces and how Lavender it tries to implicate sinister forces and say that that's what's behind the evidence, but the phrase sinister forces actually has two different meanings in Lavender's use of it, I think. Because on the one hand, his books are ostensibly, they seem to be about actual government intelligence operations throughout culture, throughout history, American history. They seem to be about that. But his actual thesis is very different. His thesis is that there's a force in the universe which is guiding and directing stuff. And that's the thing that's actually making these things seem connected when they're not. Like, so it's like he has it both ways.
Well, that's the Lovecraft connection. That's the Lovecraft codex. The Lovecraft Codex was his original choice for title, but the publisher made him change it to Lovecraft Code, making him sound like a Dan Brown wannabe, with code. But yeah, but that what you're describing is that not the essence of Lovecraft, the ancient ones, the old ones? This is the force. The ultimate sinister force that rule, that runs the universe. Well, okay, but maybe there is some, maybe not Dexter forces, but there, if there's a left sinister, there's always a right? So,
Well,
and
yeah, of course. I mean, that's when we're talking about the deeper level of things, and it's not as though I disagree anyway with the essence of this, that there are human forces manipulating things, but then there's a deeper force that's guiding and directing everything that's happening. It's just that, well, there just seems to me to be. And this isn't just about Lavender, it's actually about all of us, because we have this, selective use of knowledge, right? We'll apply it when it's to our convenience or not. But that there's a way to misapply this thing, this mixing of the levels, so that if there are certain human agendas or connections between humans that implicate you or the things you believe in, then, oh, that's just these mysterious forces, But when you actually want to create the narrative, when you're busy creating the narrative you want to create, so in the specific case, Lavender is interested in the JFK assassination and that narrative that these people are all pulled in and they're all part of a plot. That's convenient to whatever story he's selling, let's say, not to be uncharitable, but whereas the fact that Crowley, there's all of this evidence that Crowley was complicit with and certainly aware of organized ritual child abuse, that's inconvenient. And so then that's just circumstantial. Or if it gets too compelling, then it could just be the sinister four, the coincidence goblin is what he calls it.
Yeah, he's always got a way out. Or as you, about the thing about coincidences, I mean, I'm all for, I cultivate synchronicities, but I also get like, Freud with the cigar. Gentlemen, sometimes a coincidence is just a coincidence. And,
So,
but yeah,
yeah.
well, go on. Why don't you go on?
Well, I mean, okay, so I mean, one of the things I'm aware of in myself is that I have a desire to smash the sacred cows, to bring down authority figures, particularly if they've had authority over my psyche. Now, Lavender isn't the case of that. I've never particularly put much stock in what he did. I've had good conversations with him, but I've definitely never, his worldview hasn't informed my own in the way that Strieber has. But lately, Lavender has been publicly, I would say, attacking me, not in big ways, but little ways, in a way that's actually dishonest. Like he's claiming I have a visceral hatred of Strieber and that I'm doing this and I'm doing that, and he's putting words in my mouth that are, so there is a personal element at this point, and so I'm wary about that. I don't want that to inform my desire to put Lavender under the microscope and crack the Lavender code, as you put it. But on the other hand, there's something quite compelling there. And the last time I spoke to Lavender, the first thing I asked him, because I was already having feelings about this, was, well, you know, Peter, a lot of people might think that because of you being in the right place at the right time so often that you were an intelligence operative. You do know that, right? And I framed it in that way because there's no way I'm going to say, hey, are you or aren't you? Because there's no point, right? And you can offend somebody. So, and of course, he said, yeah, ha ha ha. I get that all the time, but no, right? But since that time, as I'm sure you've noticed, especially if you just, even if you've just been reading my blog, there's all this stuff coming up suggesting.
Whoops, I lost your I lost the audio. Ah, what? Whoa, one of us is it me or you? I don't know.
Well, that's what happened. I was not able to speak to Tom anymore about what the evidence suggested about Peter Lavender's affiliations, at least not until a day or two later when I did speak to him again. That conversation will be up next Wednesday, the 1st of February 2017. Until then, this is Jason Horsley at The Liminalist, the podcast between. Many thanks to those who have donated and who have supported this podcast, and appreciate your ongoing comments, feedback, and all the rest. I haven't been blogging lately. I'm busy prepping two books for publication. I will try to get something up at the blog in the future. I do have a very small online group. It's actually tiny right now, in a private area of the forum, which is a kind of revivification of the sweater process. It's still in its early, hence experimental stages. But if anyone is interested, you can apply for free participation by filling in the horticulture form, or if you've already done so, by contacting me. That form is at, oh, just go to the website. It's in the community area of the menu on the right-hand side of the menu bar. Until then, till next time, liminalizing away into the silent void of being. But I'm not the only one who sees it rising up. I said